Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, my guest is Seth Wilner, and we'll be talking about holistic management and whole farm planning. Seth is an extension field specialist with the University of New Hampshire Extension Office, where he teaches and works as a holistic manager and whole farm planner, among his many other duties. For those of you not familiar with it, in a nutshell, the Cooperative Extension Office is a program through the United States Department of Agriculture and the land-grant universities of the various states that combines informal education with research-based information to improve citizens' lives. Though programs vary by state, they include offerings on food and farming, the environment, home and community economics, and youth programs, such as 4-H. I spoke with Seth because of the possible synergistic role holistic management, whole farm planning, and permaculture could provide for profitable broad-scale permanent agriculture models that would be acceptable to more conventional modern farms while still caring for the farmers, consumers, plants, and animals involved. Recent guests such as Warren Brush and Andrew Faust set my thoughts moving on the leverage points for how to grow these ideas beyond the backyard. Connecting with farmers directly, first with those who are interested in the sustainable processes permaculture offers, and then moving upward and outward from there, can help bring our methods as permaculture practitioners into the forefront of the next green revolution. And our conversation in this interview is an important part of building and sharing that knowledge. Before we begin the conversation, I'd like to thank the following people for supporting the show: Tony Merlin, Matthew Cohn, as well as Nancy Grove and everyone at Old Path Farm. Their support and that of all listeners help the show continue to grow. If you would like to find out how you can help, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. There you will find ways to spread the word, make a donation, or follow the show on Facebook or Twitter. Also, if you have the Stitcher app for Android or iOS, you can use that to listen to the show wherever you go. Search for permaculture, and you should find me as the first result. After the conversation with Seth, I've included some additional ideas and notes at the end of the show that tie into the topics we talk about. Before we get to that, though, there is a disclaimer from one of the portions of our conversation. I asked Seth to clarify some information on the H-2A visa program about migrant farm workers. He shares what he knows about the program in order to answer my questions. However, he is not regularly involved in this process, and his statements should not be used as professional advice on the H-2A visa. Instead, if you need someone to help you with the H-2A program, please contact a lawyer familiar with the process. With that said, on to the interview.
If you can give us a little bit of your bio and background, and we can lead into the topic.
Okay. A little bit about my bio. So my name is Seth Wilner. I entered college wanting to be a veterinarian like my dad. And at the time, there was a glut of veterinarians, so way too many. And I was redirected to choose a new career. And I said, well, I like science, so I'll go into chemistry. And so I went, and I was a chemist in my undergraduate career. Sitting in a lab one summer, I thought to myself, I do not want to be mixing chemicals in the basement of a university for the rest of my life. What could I do? So I then looked at applied chemistry, and I came up with soil chemistry, really looking at nutrients, how plants took those up, how they changed in the environments they were in and the like, and graduated with a soil chemistry degree from University of Connecticut. Went into the Peace Corps in Senegal, West Africa, worked with farmers in agriculture, and really took a liking to that. So I came out of the Peace Corps and decided I would pursue my soil chemistry and nutrient management in grad school, and went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Worked there, got my master's, decided I didn't want to go on to a PhD or be in academia. I wanted to really work with farmers. So took a job in cooperative extension, working with farmers and with communities. And that was in northern Wisconsin. And family called back east. My wife and I moved to the East Coast, and I was fortunate enough to get a job with the University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension, where I've been since 2000. So 12 years, going on 13 years with UNH Cooperative Extension. And that's predominantly my background. I work with farmers on whole farm planning. Originally, I worked with nutrient management, where my degree was. Then I had a boss that suggested that we were well positioned in nutrient management with some veteran cooperative extension educators, and I should branch off into whole farm planning. I attempted to resist that. whereby he said, well, we're actually going to send you to a 3-year training in whole farm planning using holistic management methods, and my expectation is you'll be there. It's in 2 weeks. Have fun. Begrudgingly, I attended that, and that changed my life. I've been working with farmers really on a holistic whole farm planning for, about 8 to 10 years now, and I found it to be exhilarating, impactful, and quite enjoyable.
And that was why I want to talk to you today, is about holistic management and whole farm planning and how that relates to sustainable agriculture and what these processes are like. Before we get to that, though, I would like to ask you what you could tell me about mob grazing. It's a form of, I guess, intensive rotational grazing that I was introduced to on a farm tour recently, but I'm not real familiar with it. If you could give me a little bit on that, and then we can move to the main topic.
Well, actually, the topics tie in quite nicely, so it will be a seamless transition. The whole idea of holistic management is to really manage your land, your quality of life, and your economics in a sustainable manner. Mob grazing is a tool that helps to shape your land by having a very high density of livestock on land at any one point in time. It's an evolution in grazing. So whereas grazing started out with what was called set stock grazing, you have a 20-acre pasture and you fence the whole 20 acres in with a perimeter fence, send your livestock out, wish them luck, and bring them back in at night. That then evolved into rotational grazing, where you subdivided that 20-acre pasture into smaller paddocks, put the animals into the smaller paddocks, move them, you know, in whatever random order, from one paddock to the next, oftentimes based on ease of movement, and again, brought them in at night, if you will. Then management-intensive grazing evolved from there. And management-intensive grazing said, we actually can be more thoughtful in using our animals and where we place them. We could put them in certain paddocks to avoid weed issues. We could put them in certain paddocks so that they actually eat down weeds or grasses. We can put them in certain paddocks to have fire control. We can put them in certain paddocks so that they're closer to the barn when they calve or lamb or so on and so forth. So it actually had a focus on the management in moving your animals. Likewise, there was a big focus on how long any animals will stay in any given paddock and how long we need to allow the grass plants to recover. So again, a lot more emphasis on the management. How that also evolved into this mob grazing is that we found that when animals are put in high density, 40,000 to 1.5 million pounds per acre, that the animal behavior changes and that it has a differential impact on the land. So instead of just going out and putting animals in a management-intensive grazing system where it might be 10 to 15,000, maybe 20,000 pounds per acre of livestock, we bunch them together more tightly. It tends to agitate the animals a touch, and so they tend to have a different impact on the soil. Often if you have capped soils, as we call them, soils that have covered over and don't have gas and water exchange so readily, their hoof action will break that soil up. It also tends to trample in grasses and plants out there, which will increase the organic matter of the soil, which is a very healthy thing, giving food for microorganisms and earthworms. It also tends to have the animals less selective, so they eat more of the forage out there. They don't just take their favorites. So you might imagine a buffet, and you're just going to take only your favorites and leave the things you don't like. This somewhat prevents that. You have to be a very solid manager in managing a mob on your land, though, because it can have deleterious impacts on both the wildlife and the livestock and the land. But it can be a very nice tool to manage your land. And that's the whole idea behind holistic management. Let's envision what we want our land and our farmscape and our ecosystem processes on our farm to look like, and let's use tools, including livestock, to shape the ecosystem processes to improve their health, increase organic matter, increase the water cycle, improve the mineral cycle, get greater biological diversity, harvest the solar energy from the sun in a more efficient manner. Mob grazing is one tool to help get there.
Are you finding with the evolution in agriculture and moving to more sustainable systems that it becomes one of more intensive management and intentional design?
Absolutely. There was the day in agriculture, and I don't know when that ended, maybe in our grandparents' time, where you could go into production and agriculture, livestock, plants, greenhouse, ornamentals, whatever have you, grow your crop, sell it at the local market rates, and earn yourself a living. As input costs changed, as infrastructure of agriculture at the community and regional level started disappearing, the need for management has increased. That need and that increase has become larger and larger with each passing decade. So now you really have to be a good business manager and look at what your input costs are, what your cost of production are, what markets would meet the prices you need for your family and your land. Likewise, there's not enough hours in a day. So really carving out what kind of life you want on your farm and then coming up with production methods, efficiencies, products that can allow you to have time, to have the money and can carve out the life you need. That's important. And then, of course, how to maintain the environment has been a key thing being focused on over time. Things like continuous crop year after year after year with large equipment certainly can have an adverse effect on the environment. How do you mitigate for that, or how do you avoid that in entirety? So absolutely, the management side of farming from all those aspects, environmental, social, and economic, has only increased over time.
The work that you're doing with holistic management and whole farm planning then, because you're looking at both the land, the quality of life, and the action of the farmers, helps to keep the farmers on the ground so that you don't hear more of those stories of the farmer who gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning, goes and farms for 3 hours, works a day job, comes home and farms for another 3 or 4 or 5 hours. That this is more about making their farm more productive so they can spend their time farming, focused within the time that they have.
Yes, focused in the time that they have. I certainly work with farmers that get up at 4 in the morning, farm all day, and go to bed at 10 at night. And I work with the farmers that you described that squeeze in farm enterprises in between off-farm jobs. I work with farm families that have some people on the farm full-time and some people off the farm. Any and all types of farming certainly benefit by defining what it is you're managing toward. What is the life you want? What is the amount of money that the farm has to produce that goes into the family coffers? What is the amount of money the farm has to produce to be able to reinvest in the farm? And then what are the environmental conditions that we need in the farm to sustain it well into the future and to really be a healthy farmscape? And then we actually even look at what are the community needs around that farm? How do you help shape those community needs? So serve on planning boards, be on committees, farm organizations, inform legislatures about farming needs, those type of things. So the community plays a larger and larger role in the success of farming as well.
With all these elements that go into this planning, could you walk us through what this process would be like?
Okay. There is a methodology, and there's no one particular starting place in the process that I use. I will meet a farmer wherever they are at. If they are really in need of a financial planning, we'll start with the economics. If it's an environmental issue, we'll start with a land planning and environmental biological monitoring. If it is that they really need to revamp the farm, pass it on, change how things are going, create efficiencies, we'll often start with a management plan. So for the point of the conversation, I will jump in and describe some of the work that I do, but know that it need not proceed in this linear manner.
Okay.
I usually will ask the farmers on a farm to define what is it that you are managing toward. Clearly, if you don't know what you're managing toward, it's going to be simple luck that gets you a life you want. So we'll really look at the values we have around farming. You know, what do those farmers want in their life? Time with children, producing quality products, not punching a clock, being outdoors, working with livestock, working with plants, having time off with family, being able to go on a vacation, being able to bring two people full-time jobs on the farm, really laying out definitive goals based on values. So that's a really key thing, a value-based goal. We use a process to kind of tease out the values and get that down. Okay, well, having a goal is one thing, and then we put systems, practices, protocols in place so we actually can achieve that goal. So invariably, everybody wants good relationships on their farm. It takes a lot of emotional energy, and it takes a lot of time to deal with conflict on farms. So we all want positive relationships. We want good communication, things to that effect. So let's look at systems that will achieve that. So we identify systems specific to that farm that would achieve their value-based goal. So we work on defining the goal, putting systems in place, and then we really look at what do the ecosystem processes on this farm have to be like in order to sustain your system of farming, if that's livestock, if that's crops, if it's greenhouses, you name it. So we define that up front. That's kind of where I often begin. Then we'll look at financial planning. We'll say, okay, if you're an existing farm, start with a financial planning process where we'll really assess past years and we look at what are problems that we need to identify and address in order to move our farm forward towards that goal. Those would be key investments that we would want to be able to prioritize as we use our limited funds on the farm. Next, we look at the income streams coming into the farm. What are our product lines, revenue lines, grant funding, conservation inputs, whatever have you. So what are our revenue streams? What's our income coming to the farm? We then identify what is the profit that we need this farm to produce. And so some of that profit's going to leave the farm, be taken out and being used in the farm family. Some of that profit's actually going to be used to reinvest in those major expense items that we need to move the farm forward. So if we take those two elements, the income, we subtract the profit, we're actually left now with a quantifiable amount of money that we can then expend on all other expenses. That's a pretty key difference in normal farm financial planning. Farm financial planning usually takes the income, subtracts the expenses, whatever they may be, and thus you're left with your profit. With great frequency, that profit is simply not enough to create a quality of life for the farmers. So by taking the income, subtracting the profit we want, now we have a cap for expenses, and then our job becomes prioritizing all the expenses so that we can fund some, but not all. And we'll have to make decisions on what expenses we don't fund. That's a real eye-opening process in whole farm planning. It's a very empowering process because we actually now can work to derive the profit we want from our farms. So it might not happen tomorrow. It might not happen this year. It might be a multi-year process to get there. You know, there are no silver bullets in life. This certainly is a successful process to get you there in time, depending on what your fiscal situation is. So that's the financial planning process in a nutshell. We certainly look at cash flow and balancing the plan and so on and so forth, but that's it in a nutshell. And then on the environmental side, we try and take baseline data. What are our soil test results? What's our organic matter content? We can go out and we can use transects and take photos of our land and look at how much bare soil there is. We can look at what our plant communities are, what the different species or different varieties of grasses or whatever have you are on the ground. And then we can monitor change over time. So what tools can we use in the land that will change our environmental conditions towards what we want? And then we want to monitor, are we moving there? It's one thing to say, oh, these are best practices recommended by Cooperative Extension, Natural Resource Conservation Service, and any other agency. And it's something to then say, well, let's implement these practices and let's monitor. Let's assume that nature is so complex that you can't just take a recipe and apply it and be successful. So we'll look at monitoring it. So that's another process we use with the farms. And then we also certainly borrow a lot from the permaculture processes to increase efficiencies both in production and in natural functions. And so that, in a nutshell, is a whole farm planning that I do with farmers. It takes anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. I've been working with farms for actually a decade that implement it slowly over time. And so the process is quite robust. It has thus great flexibility in the system that you can modify it for your particular farm. You can also implement it slowly over time, or if you're really gung-ho, jump right in, hook, line, and sinker, and go at it.
Holistic certainly is an appropriate term for the work that you're doing. Looking at this, you're dealing with social issues, interpersonal communication on the farm, and then outside of the farm, the conversations that are going on, making sure that you're balancing the financial sheet of the farm in a functional way, taking care of the ecological side of things. Looking at the farm's finances so that they can then actually set goals and make reasonable progress towards those goals. Will you work with a farmer to change some of their techniques or farming processes in order to help them meet those goals?
Absolutely. I find that the goal setting social aspect of farming becomes one of the more significant barriers that is not addressed with any great frequency. Many agencies will help with the economics or the environmental or the production aspect of farming. There's not a great deal of agencies or organizations that help with the social aspect. So you do have a bottleneck there. Conflict, disagreement, lack of systems and protocols, lack of standard operating procedures, the business functioning of the farm, poor record keeping systems. And then the human relationship side of farming is quite something. Agriculture, as you know, has a great deal of stresses on farm families and on the whole farm entity, as it were. Long hours, often economic stress and tension. I kind of joke in my class that if you asked your spouse to marry you and you said, "Hey, will you marry me? I'll be working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. We'll probably have some fiscal tension and stress in there from limited resources, and I might be an absentee partner and an absentee parent. What do you say?" You know, who's going to say yes to that? Unfortunately, I won't say the majority of cases, but it's more frequent than we'd like. Farm life tends to have that resulting outcome. I work with farm families and to identify what are the issues that we need to address. What are the things that are depleting in this farm life for you? What are the reasons that you entered farming? What energizes you? Now let's really look at realistic systems that exist that other farms have used, that we can be creative on our own, that other businesses use that are not even agricultural businesses. So how do we create that? And so then we go out and we look at what systems work. Sometimes it's communication systems, simple as walkie-talkies and whiteboards and to-do lists and notes. Sometimes it's meetings. Monday morning, talk about what has to happen in the week. Friday evening, what didn't happen. Sometimes it's more transparent record sharing, so people are all aware of the finances. Sometimes it's ways to not lose tools. Sometimes it's identifying the expectations of your farm workers. Here's the productivity I expect within an hour chunk of time. Here's how you can hold your harvesting tools. Here's how you can arrange your boxes. This is what I expect of you. How many bushels, how many boxes, so on and so forth in an hour. Here's the quality I expect. Training workers for that. Getting managers trained and changing how they function with seasonal workers, things to that effect. So we absolutely look at all those practices. I find that to be a great deal of fun. It's not without acrimony. If you're going to really pull the carpet up and look deeply at what's going on underneath it, you certainly can get into some tensions and some issues, and you can hit some beehives pretty quickly. That's okay, though. Those have to be addressed and identified, and I really enjoy doing that with the families, and we're just honest, transparent, and I facilitate a process. And I'm never, ever surprised at the creative ingenuity that farmers come up with to solve problems.
It sounds like this process really provides you a very fulfilling intellectual outlet as you navigate all of these social and financial and ecological issues that the farmers are dealing with.
It's true. I like taking the principles that I've learned in academia and processes I learned and then applying them in creative ways. So here's the life we want. Here's the money our family needs for its personal budget and to reinvest in the farm. I mean, if it was just so simple as, let's just raise our price or lower our input, then hot dog, we're there. But it's not so simple. And so it becomes really complex. What can we do? And in what time frame can we do it in? And then how do we look at even having a record-keeping system on a farm that has 30 diversified vegetable enterprises? How do we track time for hourly labor? How do we, do cost of production? And so we put all those ag economic skills into place to look at that financial side. How is it that we can take limited land base with a variety of crops and keep that land healthy by growing those year after year after year? Or by having limited land base and here's the amount of livestock I need to produce, how can I produce those in an environmentally sustainable manner? Things to that effect. How do I communicate this to my customer base? How do I work with communities to have them change zoning policies, road use policies, things to that effect? How do I deal with, real-life issues farm families are working with, depression and physical illness, things to that effect? It takes academia, and it forces you to manipulate and adjust it and stretch it so that it has a practical application. And there is no one single thing that's going to fit every farm. So you're always having to repaint your picture with each farm. That's fascinating to me. And then the amount of trust that farmers put in you and that you put in them is also stunningly rewarding. And that just really keeps you going. Likewise, it can rip your heart out because not every farm makes it, right? A desire and an intention don't always get you there. Those farms that end up failing in these tough economic times, that's a sad week, sad month. There's no question about that. The highs are highs and the lows are low.
Well, as I was reminded by one farmer they were talking about with livestock, as you change methods, of course you have livestock, so of course you're going to have dead stock. There are always ups and downs with this. The challenges we face with everything, but when you have the complexities of a farm, and as we've had here in the Northeast this summer with drought and irrigation issues that come with that, and how quickly a single financial hit as one person becomes sick and can no longer work, the impact that that can have on the farm. It's a lot of issues.
It is a lot of issues. Absolutely. And even skilled farm labor is a pretty significant issue. So it's not necessarily, and in fact, it's not even the majority of cases where you will be able to retire on the farm, your kids will take the farm over, and you will have the farm both stay in the family and have a retirement option where, you know, you can be slowly bought out by your kids. In fact, kids aren't returning to the farm, and you can't even necessarily sell the farm today, and so it puts quite a strain on one. Likewise, getting skilled labor is increasingly difficult. Farming is certainly a highly skilled vocation. Think of the mechanics, the crop production, the timing, the planning, the business skills, all involved, marketing skills, post-harvest care, truck driving, large vehicles, tractor operation, so on and so forth. Wow, you can't pull someone off the street and say, hey, you know, let's make you a farmer tomorrow.
With finding skilled farm labor, does the issue of migrant labor factor into that? I mean, one of the conversations in the United States is about migrant farm workers and especially immigrants who are doing a lot of that work. And do you see issues with that?
What a huge topic that is. It's yet again the complexity of, you know, immigration policy. I work with farmers that by and large feel that the H-2A program specifically, where they can get migrant workers in, that those workers, almost in all cases, well exceed any worker that they can hire who's an American citizen. The work ethic is different. The stamina, the tolerance is different. And so, and it's not that the pay wage is any lower. In fact, sometimes it's even higher. But the production they get per worker, they are almost in all cases leaning towards the migrant worker. With that program being cut, with the mandate that you can't hire a migrant worker over any U.S. citizen, is really a strain for them. So they are trying to work through the political system to really have the H-2A program bulked up and brought back to where it was yesteryear. But yeah, that's a large, large, large issue.
For people who aren't familiar with the H-2A program, can you give us like an elevator pitch of what that is?
Limited. So you apply to an organization that will then seek workers out from different countries. In my neck of the woods, there are a lot of workers that come from Jamaica and the Caribbean, and they then come to work on your farm. You have to provide housing for them. You have to provide, you know, transportation so they can get groceries. These all meet certain standards, the housing. You have to pay them, I think it's 10 and change dollars an hour. You can't pay any other work on your farm less than what you pay them if they work in a similar area on the farm, similar skill sets. They come for a specific period of time. Oftentimes they'll arrive in my county in April, May, and they'll leave in November, December as a general rule of thumb. And they do all kinds of field work. And so that's how the program works. It used to be that you could interview people and choose the best worker for the job. And I believe that the law now states that you have to give an American citizen preference over an H-2A worker, and that's irrespective of skill level. That's something about the law that the farmers don't seem to like. It really I mean, it's, again, can't I hire the person I want on my farm who has the most skill and can do the best job? So, and that's not the case now. So, yeah, that exacerbates the labor situation.
Two, I think it's misquote Yogi Berra. I think that a lot of people think of farming that it's not rocket surgery. They don't need someone skilled to do that work. But I think about my father and not having people who are farming come in, as my father was a farmer as a child and told stories of how his grandfather had lost the farm and then his father had wanted him to become a skilled worker that wasn't a farmer. And then as he became a skilled blue-collar laborer, he trained me then as I was coming up to be an academic and to have a white-collar job so that if I ever needed anything done, I could just pay someone else to do it, that I would never go back to the land and have to go back to that kind of a lifestyle. And I wonder if that's just a generational push in the United States has gone for that, and that's why we're losing this skilled farm labor.
Something to be said to that. I know that the precision machine industry was just a shining star in the Northeast, I guess across the country, but certainly where I am in the Connecticut River Valley of New Hampshire and then across in Vermont and then going all the way down into Connecticut. And the people that were able to make machines that make machines, that's what the precision machine industry is, it was the farmers that were the first people that had the skill sets to do that. You had to have engineering skills, you had to have mechanical skills, you had to be able to use tools, and you had to be able to put out a very precise product. And so all those things comprise farming, knowing how to use equipment, knowing how to run equipment, knowing how to think and then plan ahead, knowing how to lay out land, and then throwing all the business skills of farming. Yeah, it is a highly skilled vocation, and as you said, is often not regarded as such. And, you know, likewise, we have a consumer base that also doesn't respect the vocation of farming in that manner. You know, so, well, you know, eat your way through a farmer's, pick your own strawberry field and pay for, you know, 2/3 of what you actually ate or picked, complain about the price at times, you know, well, why is it this much? Not even realizing what it takes in labor and input costs is something. Or people that have retired from a variety of other different professions and then want to go into farming. And I think it's like Green Acres, you know, you're an investment banker or a lawyer and you buy some land in the country and boom, you're going to be a farmer. And it's just romantic and holy moly. I work with a lot of those people that find out the hard way how difficult farming is to be successful at it.
I just try to garden and I think about how horrible that can be some years, let alone to be growing acres and acres and acres of livestock or plants or whatever it is that a particular farmer is producing.
And then growing it and then also planning. So think of the succession plans, multiple crops such as four plantings of broccoli, such as taking a certain population of your livestock to market each year and then having the replacement stock, such as trying to predict loss to death or to critters, the coyotes, whatever have you, or disease outbreaks in greenhouses or things to that effect. All that forward planning that allows you to actually garner a living and then having the diversified skills. In my county, 3 of the last 5 years, our apple crops have frosted out. So not only if you're an orchardist, you need to know about apple production and all that that involves, which is quite something, the different varieties, the pest management, the fertility. You also better have other enterprises on your farm, whether that's going to be raspberries, blueberries, whether that's going to be flowers, whether it's going to be corn mazes, whatever have you. So you have to know a variety of different skills and a variety of different crops to be able to mitigate your risk on any one crop. It's quite something.
Are you finding that having those secondary operations on a farm to take that to another level, that if someone is taking their product that they're growing, such as their apples, their blueberries, and doing value-added products, perhaps like turning those apples into applesauce or cider or their berries into jellies and jams, are processes like that adding to the income for a farm?
In many cases, yes. And it depends on the commodity. So with our low milk prices in the fluid milk market, absolutely. If you cannot sell fluid milk, which is at oftentimes a loss, and you can sell cheese, you can sell yogurt, you can sell pudding, whatever have you, absolutely, that is usually a winner. Or if you can bottle your own milk and sell that fluid milk by the bottle and not just in bulk to a processor, absolutely. If you are a blueberry grower and you have a pick-your-own operation, selling just pick-your-own blueberries seems to be profitable, although we have some new pests coming on the scene, spotted-winged Drosophila, I'm thinking of specifically, that is somewhat a game changer. But in general, pick your own blueberries and pick your own apples really were doing fairly well. Vegetables, hit or miss, depending on what your fixed cost and debt level is. You could sell that in a combination of retail markets and wholesale markets and maybe to restaurants or having a CSA share, and that you might be able to sell in a non-value-added manner. And yet, sometimes you might go value-added and sell pesto, sell jams, sell jellies, dehydrated tomatoes, you know, sun-dried tomato type of thing. It depends on the commodity and the operation, which again comes down to working with whole farm planning. What are your needs? What is your debt? What's your profitability? What's the profit you need to take from the farm? What's your labor force? What's the land base? It always comes down to it. There's never a one-size-fits-all, which is neat. And then, is your market saturated? Is everybody and their brother selling jams and jellies? Or, you know, is it a reasonable market to enter? Yogurt, cheese, so on and so forth.
Which goes back to your planning and then doing your business plan so you know who your competitors are and what the prices are and what your inputs would be to produce that.
Exactly. You know, there's a great example. In my county, sweet corn ranges from $3 to $9 a dozen. So knowing what it costs you to produce a dozen ear of sweet corn, knowing what your market will bear based on where you are in the county, then knowing what you need to take as profit will dictate what price you can charge and whether sweet corn pays for itself or not.
That $3 to $9 figure, is that your production cost per dozen?
Nope, that's what it sells for. The production cost per dozen actually ranges per farm. I would throw out an average that of the farmers that have shared the production cost with me, the average is about $5.25, although that average was 2 years ago and costs have gone up even more. So I don't know what they are right now. But if you want to just say $5.25 to $5.75 on average, again, it's really specific to the farm. What equipment do you own? What equipment, what's the state of that equipment? What's your debt load? What is the scale that you're producing it on? So on and so forth. But here it is, though, the price that customers are paying ranges from 3 to 9. Where are you in that market? And then what do you need to be at? So if you're in an area where you have enough farms producing at $3 a dozen, good luck selling it at 6, right? And yet if your farm needs to get to $6 a dozen to be able to break even or be profitable, then maybe sweet corn's not a viable enterprise, and maybe you need to really look at that.
$9 a dozen just hurts my brain because I think I was paying as little as $3.25 a dozen at my local farmer's market this year.
You know, it's an interesting thing when you actually crunch numbers and you get an aha moment with farmers. So at $3, $4, $5 a dozen, if you're losing money on it, you're like, whoa. You'd be better off with your time and the physical wear and tear on your body and your equipment to sit down, watch TV, and burn your money that you're losing than you would be to go and grow this crop and take all the labor it needed and lose money on it. The same with hay. What is the cost of production for hay? That ranges anywhere from $3.50 to $6 a bale, depending on first or second cut. And if you don't know your cost of production, you could be selling hay at a loss, which is frequent when we work with numbers that we find, I'm actually taking a loss on this.
And as a consumer who's interested in taking care of the people who I buy from, these numbers are kind of shocking to know that farmers are selling at a loss, and this much of a loss.
Yeah, it's shocking to the farmer. It'd probably be shocking to the consumer. And yet, sometimes if you were to say, so farmers like, well, how do I actually sell my sweet corn at $6 a dozen then? You know, the consumer wants to buy it at this cheaper cost. And we talk about strategies to do that. Can you share that information with the customer? Can you switch markets? Can you try and grow a premium variety of corn? You know, what are you going to do? Because not all consumers have that altruistic mindset you've just expressed of, I really want to support you. Allow me to pay a price that keeps you in business. Instead, they're like, well, I can go to, you know, the grocery store down the road and pay this. Complaints are certainly not uncommon when you have to price for true cost of production and profitability.
A conversation I had with an organic farmer once was that the price that he was selling at market represented a true cost for his inputs. He was selling it 2 to 3 times the cost in the grocery store because all of his inputs had been accounted for.
And that's often the case. And then one would even ask, did he take his time as an input or not? Sometimes you would sell it at the cost of your direct inputs and even factor in, you know, your fixed costs, but not your time. If you actually put your time in there, 2 to 3 times or better for market prices, grocery store prices. It's not uncommon.
Is that part of your planning then, that you sit down with the farmer and you look at those numbers and you go, okay, now what do you want to pay yourself? And then try to work out like a per hour figure or an annual salary that they can earn from their farm?
Yeah, I don't pay attention much to the per hour figure, although people do. There's a great book by Richard Wiswall called The Organic Farmer's Business Handbook. He'll actually break it down on a per hour basis. We look at it more of a macro level. What does this farm need to deliver to your family for you to live? So what's your family budget? Then know that the farm has to create that much profit for you to survive. Actually, it's a little more complicated, but it's not too complicated. What's your family budget? What are non-farm income streams? So you take the family budget, subtract out the non-farm income streams, and then that's what the farm needs to produce for your family to survive. And then we say, well, let's look at your enterprises. Let's look at what the cost of production are for those and your price points and see, can we raise your price points? Can we change your enterprise mix? Can we create efficiencies to lower your costs of production? Those type of things to try and derive that profit level.
A lot of work to put in and get all this planned out.
It's a lot of work. It's a very satisfactory work. I consider myself nothing but fortunate to have the job I do.
As my listeners are largely people who are interested in sustainability and permaculture and those kinds of practices, if someone wanted to go and learn holistic management and whole farm planning, is that something that they can just go and do without a background in agriculture? Or is there some educational steps that they should take first before they go off and learn about this?
I've taught people that didn't have a background in agriculture. They did just fine, might have taken some more effort. Likewise, those steeped in the business of agriculture and the skills of production, you know, I think will take to it more quickly. The goal setting, certainly discerning a value-based goal, doesn't require a background in agriculture, although understanding the culture of farms and farm families absolutely is an advantage, no question about it. In terms of putting systems in place for a farm, if you don't know anything about agriculture, you are at a strong disadvantage, but you could facilitate a process in which the farmers might be able to come up with some systems. But again, you're at a strong disadvantage because you can't help their thinking and can't add to it. In terms of farm finances, without knowing anything about agriculture, I would suspect that would be a steep uphill battle. In terms of the ecosystem processes, I think that you'd be benefited to have an idea of agriculture, but you still could learn about ecology and ecosystem processes and farm practices to that extent. So I think that people could certainly get into it, become effective and helpful, and then just build their skills over time. It took me no less than 5 years to feel I was really an asset to farmers using the holistic management whole farm planning framework. I would say that then in the next 5 years, so I've been doing this for about a decade, I really was able to refine skills and practices. One thing our conversation has not mentioned in any of this is effective education techniques. So as farming has evolved, so too has farm education. The notion of sitting farmers in a room and lecturing them with some PowerPoint material and other, you know, transmission of knowledge methods is really quite ineffective. In fact, the research shows you would gain about 30% of the information presented if you were just passively sitting in a room being lectured at. Then to be effective and to really help farmers build skills so that they have more than just some cursory knowledge, but they can translate that into behavior change, requires you to be skilled in adult education, which is well more than just the lecture. It's problem solving. It's marrying it to context. It's giving the learner choice. It's using tools like decision cases coming from the business world, those type of things, experiential education. So being effective at teaching also has an impact on how people learn.
And your ability then to take this information and make it directly meaningful to their lives and the work that they're doing.
Exactly. So this is not some academic lecture that I tell you that if you take A and subtract B, you get C, and you can just leave with that from the workshop and go home and do it. This is fairly complex, nuanced material that is specific to different farms, and so it has to be taught in a manner that you, one, relate to, and two, you can acquire the principles, and three, you can apply those. Absent the ability to apply this, this is nothing more than reading a good book or hearing a good conversation or a good lecture or watching a good movie. So it's essential if you're really going to be able to implement any of these whole farm planning skills, social, economic, or environmental level, that you have the ability to apply it.
There's more to it than just gain the knowledge and do it. It's being involved in the farming organization so that you can get to know who your local farmers are and start to hear what their issues are. Be in touch with agriculture so that you know what trends are occurring. Understand what your local ecological impacts are. Here in Pennsylvania with the Susquehanna watershed, one of our big issues is the impact on the Chesapeake Bay and daily nitrogen loads, which are going to be different from the issues that you have in New Hampshire, which would change then the ecological techniques that you might want to teach to a farmer to change that issue if they're having a problem.
Well, yes and no. So again, as we look at effective education methods, we take into account that people learn very differently. Some people really can absorb to the level of application from reading a book based on their past experience, being a farmer, being in business, so on and so forth. Some people are really hands-on. The ecological processes that we'd want to pay attention to, we would teach the same in any situation. The monitoring tools, the understanding of the water cycle, the mineral cycle, biodiversity, energy flows, so on and so forth, those would be the same. Which of those tools you would apply on your land would differ based on, are you a poultry farmer in a sensitive watershed area? Are you a cattle farmer in a non-sensitive upland area? So what tool you would use, going back to our conversation on mob grazing. So mob grazing is grazing animals at a high density. When you choose to apply that, how often you choose to apply that, depends on what your land management goal is. The same too with, of the tools we teach you, what you apply is going to be situation specific.
This provides you a very, very large toolbox that you then sit down and assemble a system from for the individual farmer.
Absolutely. I know that had past programs on permaculture, so the same too with permaculture. There's a principle guiding a methodology, and how that methodology is implemented on your land is going to be unique to your situation, your goals, your finances, your land. So we wouldn't say, this crop always goes in zone 4, and this crop always goes in zone 1. It doesn't work that way. Here's the principles, and then what are the things that need daily attention? What are the things that are perennial that can go in a place that you aren't going to give them the daily attention that you would others? Things to that effect. You would teach the principles, and you'd give them enough information and skills to apply it. And then farming is certainly a learn-by-doing vocation, no question.
You have to be out there in the fields getting covered in mud and everything else in order to really get the experience and knowledge to really farm.
Right. So you're going to start off at one level, and then by doing and making mistakes and or having success, you're going to be able to ratchet that skill set up. You had mentioned the community. So you have success, or you have failure, you have questions, and then you have a variety of community resources to turn to, other farmers being a prime resource, agency people such as the universities and the land grant extension systems and the natural resource conservation systems and conservation districts, so on and so forth. Those certainly are going to be another resource in your community. By then doing that and implementing those practices, you have another year of experience, right? And so, lo and behold, every successive year you have, you gain more and more skills. And so skills that you just simply, there's no substitute for time and experience out there.
This isn't something that someone's going to go spend a week learning and then just go out and start doing. They'll want to have the experience and be keyed in and build over time.
I would say so. So the only take-home message is don't be afraid that, oh, this is so complex, but instead have patience and know that it's time-honored.
And that regardless of your background, if you find that you have a passion for this, that you can pursue it, but understand that it will take time.
I would feel comfortable with that. You're going to have a tougher row to hoe, for sure, if you have no agricultural background than if you did. No question there. I wouldn't say, oh, if you haven't grown up farming or gardening, stay away from it. I wouldn't deter anyone from that. If you have the intention and you have the passion, there's enough resources out there. I'd like to think that I could help anybody that came to me. How successful they would be depends on factors well beyond my skill to help them, their motivation, their ability to change, external market forces, so on and so forth, but I certainly would give it a fighting shot.
You'll do your best to help them along the way.
Absolutely.
You're practicing holistic management and whole farm planning. Is the holistic management, is that through Holistic Management International and their processes?
It is. I've worked with Holistic Management International since about 2002. Holistic Management International and the Savory Institute are the two international leaders in disseminating holistic management information. Alan Savory was the founder. He came up with this process of holistic management in its original format. It's evolved and changed over time. He was part of Holistic Management International, split off and founded his own organization, the Savory Institute. So we have two international organizations. Holistic Management International is situated in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I work a great deal with them on grant projects and other work and get a great deal of training and education from them. Likewise, the Savory Institute does a bit of a different model than just education. They actually will kind of take over struggling ranches and farms, turn them around, and either sell them or sell them back to the original owner in a more successful form. Both organizations provide skills, education, and research because the process certainly has evolved in the 10 years I've learned it.
Is there an organization that teaches whole farm planning or like started that kind of an idea and moved it forward, or is this something that's grown out of just farm management practices over the years?
For me, it's grown out of farm management practices over the years. Certainly permaculture has a place in whole farm planning. Certainly all the farm production techniques have. Certainly traditional ag economics absolutely do. Conflict resolution processes, decision-making processes, visioning processes, all that certainly I use. I try and just fill my toolbox with all these different skills and processes and experiences that I then bring into this whole farm planning umbrella, you know, which the skeletal undergirding really is my training in holistic management. But holistic management is not the only thing I use. It's certainly the skeleton that I use, the skeletal structure, and then I put flesh and muscle on and, you know, the many other processes that are out there that are absolutely credible and helpful.
If someone wanted to learn more about whole farm planning, would you then point them to start with holistic management?
I would point them with a holistic management-like program. I would say that if you want to start whole farm planning, recognize that there is a social, economic, and environmental suite of skills you're going to need to have, and that there are a variety of organizations that have some modified process, whether they were trained in holistic management or not, that could help you get there. And so ask around, Google whole farm planning, see what you come up with. There's an organization in Minnesota, the name escapes me, something Stewardship Foundation, places in Missouri. There are, you know, various whole farm planning curriculum and programs. For me, holistic management is what I was trained in. And that was funded through a SARE grant. And if your audience doesn't know about SARE, Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education, which is regional. So we have Northeast SARE, there's North Central SARE, there's Western SARE, and there's Southern SARE. And they are a grant-based program that does a great deal of training of farmers, of farm professionals, agricultural service providers. You could Google their website and whole farm planning and come up with all the various training programs they funded.
I guess my last question for this then, before I ask you for your final thoughts or anything else that you want to share, is I take from all of this that one of the most important things if someone wants to do this kind of work with farmers is to make sure that you meet the farmers where they're at and not bring your own viewpoint to the table, because you have to get their buy-in to make this work.
I would modify that by saying absolutely meet the farmers where they're at. Absolutely cut and dry, no question. You always bring your own viewpoint to the table. That's just yet another opinion in the pool. Don't bring your own bias to the table. Don't preclude other processes, other information, things to that effect. You can't bring passion if you don't bring a view. We're not automatons. We're human beings who have beliefs, who've seen things work, who've seen things fail. That can't be a blinder for you, but always meet the farmer where they're at. And that's going to be the in, that you help them to advance, and they advance as much as they want. They don't want a goal. They only want to, you know, learn how to set a financial plan, and that's what they want. Excellent. With frequency, they'll call you back in a year or two and say, we're not getting as far as we wanted to get. Do you have any ideas to help us? And you go back and you meet them where they're at there. So those type of things.
Well, thank you, Seth, for everything that you've talked with me about today. It gave an insight into agriculture that I'm only beginning to become aware of, and I'm glad to see that there are these holistic processes that are available to help people down the road and to make farmers more successful in a way that is more sustainable and ecological. With everything that we've covered, is there anything else that you'd like to share or say to the listeners?
The only thing that I would say to the listeners is a little plug. If you find the services that you've heard today valuable, these are provided by your land-grant universities. The land-grant universities, like everything else, is certainly being challenged for funding. Is that a priority given depleted resources that we as a country should invest in? Obviously, I'm biased. I believe it is. But it is under fire. And so if you believe that cooperative extension, university research, so on and so forth is a priority, then I would urge everybody to work to support it in whatever fashion they see fit, whether that's calling decision makers and expressing their strong support for it, whether that's private financing, whatever that might be. But do not take it for granted, because it's not necessarily going to be here for the long term if it is taken for granted.
I have a passionate listener base, and I am sure that they will do their best with those words to help keep this going.
Excellent. It's been my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
When it comes to whole farm planning and getting to know more about farmers and agriculture so that you can put these ideas that Seth presented into practice, there are some places I recommend you begin looking. Since permaculture deals with resilient and sustainable systems, the first place I'd go is a sustainable agriculture organization in your area, as the ones I'm familiar with offer classes and networking opportunities. The main group here in Pennsylvania is PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. Another group that I found that's very important, but offers some very low-key, informal, pleasant events, is PA Wagon, the Pennsylvania Women in Agriculture Network, a group that both my wife and I belong to. They're holding workshops, farm tours, and potlucks on a continuous basis throughout the year. And as the activities of farming slow down and we move into the northeastern winter, the focus shifts more to those kinds of social events. If you can find these kinds of organizations, take the principles of permaculture, like observe and interact, or use small and slow solutions, as your guidelines when you're in these environments. Talk less, listen more, ask questions when you don't understand. Hear what the people are saying. Though I'm not a farmer, I openly admit that when introductions go round the table at these kinds of events. I am honest that I practice permaculture and that my role is as an educator, not a farmer. I'm there to learn, just as many of them are. Along the way, I've been welcomed every time for it. So use a search engine, a phone book, a local farmer, or any other resource you can to look around, and you'll find an organization to connect with to learn more about the current state of agriculture and farmers. You can learn more about those on-the-ground needs, and you can have a more holistic picture of what these other individuals in our expanded community are dealing with. Take a step, break out of the box, and see what ways you can help use the permaculture model to aid others in building a better world. As each of us take action, we can make that happen. Also, as you heard Seth implore about the need to take care of the extension programs if you're in the United States, please take a few minutes, call the extension office near you, and thank them for the work that they're doing. See what programs they have available. Get involved. It really does make a difference in helping these programs to continue. Once you've done that, then stop back here and check out the next episode. Mary Johnson returns to provide us with an introduction to nutrient-dense farming and how we can use a simple tool to better evaluate the food we eat. Until then, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.